but there was still Phyllis. The recreational gases in the wall dispenser were mostly nitrous oxide in individual inhalers containing about 2 or 3 cubic meters of gas. The room was, he judged, about 35 or 40 cubic meters. The ventilation grill was next to the ceiling and could be blocked with a strip of the towel on its roll by the sink. He stuck money cards in the dispenser and bought all the recreational gases in it. 20 little pocket-sized bottles with nose and mouth masks, and nitrous oxide would be slightly heavier than Burroughs air. He took the little scissors out of the key compartment on his wrist pad and cut a sheet out of the continuous roll of towel. He climbed onto the toilet tank and covered the ventilation grill, stuffing the sheet into the slits. There were still gaps, but they were small. He climbed back down and went over to the door. There was a gap at the bottom of the door, almost a centimeter tall. He cut some more strips from the towel. Phyllis was snoring. He went to the door, opened it, kicked the gas bottles out, and stepped out after them. He took one last look at Phyllis, prone on the floor, and then closed the door. He stuffed the towel strips under the door, leaving only a small opening at one corner. Then, after glancing up and down the hall, he sat down and took a bottle and shaped the flexible mask to the hole he had left, and shot the contents of the bottle into the men's room. He did that 20 times, stuffing the empty bottles in his pockets until they were full, and then making a little satchel for the remainder out of the last strip of towel. He got up and clanked over to the cart and sat down in the driver's seat. He stepped on the accelerator and the car jerked forward in a movement the opposite of the sudden stop that had thrown Phyllis off the back seat and onto the floor. That would have hurt. He stopped the cart. He got out and ran back to the men's room, clinking and clanking. He jerked open the door, walked in, holding his breath, and grabbed Phyllis's ankles and hauled her out into the air. She was still breathing and had a little smile on her face. Sachs resisted the impulse to kick her and ran back to the cart. He drove to the other side of Hunt Mesa at full speed and then took the elevator there down to the subway level. He got on the next subway train and waited out the trip across town to South Station. He observed that his hands were trembling and the two big knuckles on his right hand were swollen and turning blue. They hurt a good deal. At the station, he bought a ticket south, but when he gave the ticket and his ID to the ticket taker at the track entrance, the man's eyes went round, and he and his associates actually pulled their pistols to make the arrest, calling out nervously for help from people in another room. Apparently, Phyllis had come to faster than his calculations had led him to expect. Part 5. Homeless. Biogenesis is, in the first place, psychogenesis. This truth was never more manifest than on Mars, where noosphere preceded biosphere, the layer of thought first enwrapping the silent planet from afar, inhabiting it with stories and plans and dreams, until the moment when John stepped out and said, "Here we are," from which point of ignition the green force spread like wildfire until the whole planet was pulsing with viriditas. It was as if the planet itself had felt something missing, and at the tap of mind against rock, noosphere against lithosphere, the absent biosphere had sprung into the gap with the startling suddenness of a magician's paper flower. Or so it seemed to Michel Duval, who was passionately devoted to every sign of life in the rust waste, who had seized Hiroko's areophany with the fervor of a drowning man thrown a buoy. It had given him a new way of seeing. To practice this sight, he had taken on Anne's habit of walking outside in the hour before sunset, and in the long shadowed landscapes he found every patch of grass a piercing delight. In each little tangle of sedge and lichen, he saw a miniature Provence. This was his task, as he now conceived it, the hard work of reconciling the centrifugal antinomy of Provence and Mars. He felt that in this project he was part of a long tradition, for recently in his studies he had noticed that the history of French thought was dominated by attempts to resolve extreme antinomies. For Descartes, it had been mind and body. For Sartre, Freudianism and Marxism. For Théod de Chardin, Christianity and evolution. The list could be extended, and it seemed to him that the particular quality of French philosophy, its heroic tension and its tendency to be a long march of magnificent failures, came from this repeated attempt to yoke together impossible opposites. Perhaps they were all, including his, attacks on the same problem, the struggle to knit together spirit and matter. And perhaps this was why French thought had so often welcomed complex rhetorical apparatuses such as the semantic rectangle, structures which might bind these centrifugal oppositions in nets strong enough to hold them. So now it was Michel's work patiently to knit green spirit and rust matter, to discover the Provence in Mars. Crustose lichen, for instance, made parts of the red plain look as if they were being plated with apple jade. And now, in the lucid indigo evenings, the old pink skies had made grass look brown, the sky's color allowed every blade of grass to radiate such pure greens that the little meadow lawns seemed to vibrate, the intense pressure of color on the retina. Such delight! And it was awesome as well to see how fast this primitive biosphere had taken root and flowered and spread. There was an inherent surge toward life, a green electric snap between the poles of rock and mind, an incredible power which here had reached in and touched the genetic chains, inserted sequences, created new hybrids, helped them to spread, changed their environments to help them grow. The natural enthusiasm of life for life was everywhere clear, how it struggled and so often prevailed. But now there were guiding hands as well, a noosphere bathing all from the start. The green force, bolting into the landscape with every touch of their fingertips. So that human beings were miraculous indeed. Conscious creators walking this new world like fresh young gods, wielding immense alchemical powers. So that anyone Michel met on Mars he regarded curiously, wondering as he looked at their often innocuous exteriors, what kind of new Paracelsus or Isaac of Holland stood before him, and whether they would turn lead to gold or cause rocks to blossom. The American rescued by Coyote and Maya was no more or less remarkable on first acquaintance than any other person Michel had met on Mars. More inquisitive, perhaps, more ingenuous, it seemed. A bulky, shambling man with a swarthy face and a quizzical expression. But Michel was used to looking past that kind of surface to the transformative spirit within, and quickly he concluded that they had a mysterious man on their hands. His name was Art Randolph, he said, and he had been salvaging useful materials from the fallen elevator. Carbon? Maya had asked. But he had missed or ignored her sarcastic tone and replied, yes, but also, and he had rattled off a whole list of exotic brecciated minerals. Maya had only glared at him, but he hadn't appeared to notice. He only had questions. Who were they? What were they doing out there? Where were they taking him? What kind of cars were these? Were they really invisible from space? How did they get rid of their thermal signals? Why did they need to be invisible from space? Could they be part of the legendary lost colony? Were they part of the Mars underground? Who were they, anyway? No one was quick to answer these questions, and it was Michel who finally said to him, we are Martians. We live out here on our own. The underground. Incredible. I would have said you guys were a myth, to tell you the truth. This is great. Maya only rolled her eyes, and when their guest asked to be dropped off at Ekus Overlook, she laughed nastily and said,
Get serious.
What do you mean? Michelle explained to him that as they couldn't release him without revealing their presence, they might not be able to release him at all. Oh, I wouldn't tell anyone. Maya laughed again. Michelle said, It's a matter that is too important for us to trust a stranger, and you might not be able to keep it a secret. You would have to explain how you had gotten so far from your vehicle.
You could take me back to it.
We don't like to spend time around things like that. We wouldn't have come close to it if we hadn't noticed you were in trouble.
Well, I appreciate it, but I must say this isn't much of a rescue.
Better than the alternative, Maya told him sharply.
Very true. And I do appreciate it, really, but I promise I won't tell anyone. And you know it isn't as if people don't know you're out here. TV back home has shows about you all the time.
Even Maya was silenced by that. They drove on. Maya got on their intercom and had a brief bursted exchange in Russian with Coyote, who was traveling in the rover ahead of them with Kasey and Nirgal. Coyote was adamant. As they had saved the man's life, they could certainly rearrange it for a time to keep themselves out of danger. Michelle reported the gist of the exchange to their prisoner. Randall frowned briefly, then shrugged. Michelle had never seen a faster adjustment to the rerouting of a life. The man's sang-froid was impressive. Michelle regarded him attentively while also keeping one eye on the front camera screen. Randolph was already asking questions again about the rover's controls. He only made one more reference to his situation after looking at the radio and intercom controls.
I hope you'll let me send some kind of message to my company so they'll know I'm safe. I work for Dump Mines, a part of Praxis. You and Praxis have a lot in common, really. They can be very secretive, too. You ought to contact them just for your own sake, I swear. You must have some coded bands that you use, right?
No response from Maya or Michelle. And later, when Randolph had gone into the rover's little toilet chamber, Maya hissed,
He's obviously a spy. He was out there deliberately so we would pick him up.
That was Maya. Michelle didn't try to argue with her, but only shrugged. We're certainly treating him like one. And then he was back out among them and asking more questions. Where did they live? What was it like hiding all the time? Michelle began to be amused at what seemed more and more like a performance or even a test. Randolph appeared perfectly open, ingenuous, friendly, his swarthy face almost that of a mooncalf simpleton, and yet his eyes watched them very carefully, and with every unanswered question he looked more interested and more pleased, as if their answers were coming to him by telepathy. Every human was a great power, every human on Mars an alchemist, and though Michelle had given up psychiatry a long time ago, he could still recognize the touch of a master at work. He almost laughed at the growing urge he felt in himself to confess everything to this hulking, quizzical man, still clumsy in the Martian G. Then their radio beeped and a compressed message lasting no more than 2 seconds buzzed over the speakers.
See? Randolph said helpfully. You could get a message out to Praxis just like that.
But when the AI finished running the message through the decryption sequence, there was no more joking. Sachs had been arrested in Barrows. At dawn, they drew up with Coyote's car and spent the day conferring about what to do. They sat in a cramped circle in the living compartment, their faces all lined and etched with worry, all except their prisoner, who sat between Nirgal and Maya. Nirgal had shaken hands with him and nodded as if they were old friends, although neither had said a word. But the language of friendship was not in words. The news about Sachs had come from Spencer by way of Nadia. Spencer was working in Kasey Vallis, which was a kind of new Korolyov, a security town very sophisticated and at the same time very low profile. Sachs had been taken to one of the compounds there, and Spencer had found out about it and made the call out to Nadia.
We have to get him out, Maya said, and fast. They've only had him a couple days.
The Sachs Russell? Randolph was saying.
Wow, I can't believe it. Who are you all, anyway? Hey, are you Maya Toitovna?
Maya cursed him in livid Russian. Coyote ignored them all. He hadn't said anything since the message had arrived and was busy at his AI screen looking at what appeared to be weather satellite photos.
You might as well let me go, Randolph said into the silence. I couldn't tell them anything they won't get out of Russell.
He won't tell them anything, Kasey said hotly.
Randolph waggled a hand. Scare him, maybe hurt him a little, put him under, plug him in, dope him up, and zap his brain in the right places. They'll get answers to whatever they ask. They've got it down to a science, as I understand it.
He was staring at Kasey.
You look familiar, too.
Never mind. Anyway, if they can't tweak it out, they can usually do it more crudely.
How do you know all this? Maya demanded.
Common knowledge, Randolph said.
So maybe it's all wrong, but...
I want to go get him, Coyote said.
But they'll know we're out here, Kasey said.
They know that anyway. What they don't know is where we are.
Besides, Michelle said, it's our sacks, Coyote said.
Hiroko won't object.
If she does, tell her to fuck off, Maya exclaimed.
Tell her Shikata Ganai.
It would be my pleasure, Coyote said.
The western and northern slopes of the Tharsis Bulge were unpopulated relative to the eastern drop to Noctis Labyrinthus. There were a few aerothermal stations and aquifer wells, but much of the region was covered in a year-round blanket of snow and fern and young glaciers. Winds out of the south collided with the strong northwest winds coming around Olympus Mons, and the blizzards could be fierce. The proto-glacial zone extended up from the 6 or 7 kilometer contour nearly to the base of the great volcanoes. It was not a good place to build, nor was it a good place for stealth cars to hide. They drove hard over the sastrugi and along ropey lava mounds that served as roads, north past the bulk of Tharsis Tholis, a volcano that was about the size of Mauna Loa, though under the rise of Ascrius it looked like a cinder cone. The next night they made it off the snow and northeast across Ekkis Chasma and hid for the day under the stupendous eastern wall of Ekkis, just a few kilometers north of Sax's old headquarters at the top of the cliff. The east wall of Ekkis Chasma was the great escarpment at its absolute greatest, a cliff 3 kilometers tall running in a straight line north and south for 1,000 kilometers. The areologists were still arguing over its origin, as no ordinary force of landscape formation seemed adequate to have created it. It was simply a break in the fabric of things separating the floor of Ekkis Chasma from the high plateau of Luni Plenum. Michel had visited Yosemite Valley in his youth, and he still recalled those towering granite cliffs, but this wall standing before them was as long as the whole state of California and 3 kilometers high for most of that length. A vertical world, its massive plains of red rock staring out blankly to the west, glowing in each empty sunset like the side of a continent. At its northern end, this incredible cliff finally became less tall and less steep, and just above 20 degrees north it was cut by a deep, broad channel which ran east through Luni Plateau down onto the Crisi Basin. This big canyon was Kasey Vallis, one of the clearest manifestations of ancient flooding anywhere on Mars. A single glance at a satellite photo and it was obvious that a very large flood had run down Ekkis Chasma once upon a time, until it reached a break in its great eastern wall, perhaps a graben. The water had turned right down this valley and smashed through it with fantastic force, eroding the entrance until it was a smooth curve, slopping over the outside bank of the turn and ripping at joints in the rock until they were a complex gridwork of narrow canyons. A central ridge in the main valley had been shaped into a long lemniscate, or tear-shaped island, the shape as hydrodynamic as a fishback. The inner bank of the fossil water course was incised by 2 canyons that had been mostly untouched by water, ordinary fossae that showed what the main channel had probably looked like before the flood. 2 late meteor strikes on the highest part of the inner bank had completed the shaping of the terrain, leaving fresh, steep craters.
From the ground, driving slowly on to the rise of the outer bank, it was a rounded elbow of a valley with the Lemniscate Ridge and the round ramparts of the craters on the rise of the inner bank the most prominent features. It was an attractive landscape, reminiscent of the Burrows region in its spatial majesty, the great sweep of the main channel just begging to be filled with running water, which no doubt would be a shallow, braided stream coursing over pebbles and cutting new beds and islands every week. But now it was the site for the transnational security compound. The two craters on the inner bank had been tented, as had big sections of the gridwork terrain on the outer bank and part of the main channel on both sides of the Lemniscate Island, but none of this work was ever shown on the video or mentioned in the news. It was not even on the maps. Spencer had been there since the beginning of construction, however, and his infrequent reports out had told them what the new town was for. These days, almost all the people found guilty of crimes on Mars were sent out to the asteroid belt to work off their sentences in mining ships. But there were people in the Transitional Authority who wanted a jail on Mars itself, and Cassay Vallis was it. Outside the valley entrance, they hid their boulder cars in a knot of boulders, and Coyote studied weather reports. Maya fumed at the delay, but Coyote shrugged her off. "This isn't going to be easy," he told her sternly. "And it isn't possible at all, except in certain circumstances. We need to wait for some reinforcements to arrive, and we need to wait on the weather. This is something Spencer and Sachs himself helped me to set up, and it is very clever, but the initial conditions have to be right." He returned to his screens, ignoring them all, talking to himself or to the screen's alchemist, his dark, thin face flickering in their light. "Alchemist, indeed," Michel thought, muttering as if over alembic or crucible, "working his transmutations on the planet. A great power." And now focused on the weather. Apparently he had discovered some prevailing patterns in the jet stream tied to certain anchoring points in the landscape. "It's a question of the vertical scale," he said brusquely to Maya, who with all her questions was beginning to sound like Art Randolph. "This planet has a 30K span top to bottom, 30,000 meters, so there are strong winds." "Like the Mistral," Michel offered. "Yes, katabatic winds, and one of the strongest of them drops off the Great Escarpment here." The prevailing winds in the region, however, were westerlies. When these hit the Ekkis Cliff, towering updrafts resulted, and flyers living in Ekkis Overlook took advantage of them for sport, flying all day in gliders or bird suits. But fairly frequently, cyclonic systems came by, bringing winds from the east, and when that happened, cold air ran over the snow-covered Luni Plateau, scouring snow and becoming denser and colder until the entire drainage area was funneled out through notches in the great cliff's edge, and the winds then fell like an avalanche. Coyote had studied these katabatic winds for some time, and his calculations had led him to believe that when conditions were right, sharp temperature contrasts, a developed storm track east to west across the plateau, then very slight interventions in certain places would cause the downdrafts to turn into vertical typhoons, smashing down into Ekkis Chasma and blasting north and south with immense power. When Spencer had identified for them the nature and purpose of the new settlement in Cassay Vallis, Coyote had immediately decided to try to create the means to effect these interventions. "Those idiots built their prison in a wind tunnel," he muttered at one point in answer to Maya's inquisition. "So we built a fan, or rather a switch, to turn the fan on. We dug in some silver nitrate dispensers at the top of the cliff. Big monster jet hoses. Then some lasers to burn the air just over the flow zone. That creates an unfavorable pressure gradient, damming up the normal outflow so that it's stronger when it finally breaks through. And explosives installed all down the cliff face to push dust into the wind and make it heavier. See, wind heats up as it falls, and that would slow it down some if it weren't so full of snow and dust. I climbed down that cliff 5 times to set it all up. You should have seen it. Set some fans as well."
Of course, the power of the whole apparatus is negligible compared to the total wind force, but sensitive dependence is the whole key to weather, you see. And our computer modeling located the spots to push the initial conditions the way we want. Or so we hope.
You haven't tried it? Maya asked. Coyote stared at her.
We tried it in the computer. It works fine. If we get initial conditions of 150-kilometer cyclonic winds over Luni, you'll see.
They must know about these katabatic winds in Kasei, Randolph pointed out.
They do. But what they calculated as once-in-a-millennium winds, we think we can create any time the initial conditions are there on top.
Guerrilla climatology, Randolph said, eyes bugged out. What do you call that? Climatage? Attack meteorology? Coyote pretended to ignore him, although Michelle saw a brief grin through the dreadlocks. But his system would only work with the proper initial conditions. There was nothing to do but sit and wait and hope they developed. During these long hours, it seemed to Michelle that Coyote was trying to project himself through his screen out into the sky.
Come on,
the wiry little man urged under his breath, nose against glass.
Push, push, push! Come over that hill, you bastard wind! Tuck and turn, spiral tight, come on!
He wandered the darkened car when the rest of them were trying to sleep, muttering,
Look, yes, look!
And pointing at features of satellite photos that none of the rest of them could see. He sat brooding over scrolling meteorological data, chewing on bread and cursing, whistling like a wind. Michelle lay on his narrow cot, head propped on his hand, watching in fascination as the wild man prowled through the dimness of the car, a small, shadowy, secretive, shamanesque figure. And the bearish lump of their prisoner, one eye agleam, was likewise awake to witness this nocturnal scene, rubbing his scruffy jaw with an audible rasping, glancing at Michelle as the whispering continued.
Come on, damn you, come on, show! Blow like an October hurricane!
Finally, at sunset on their second day of waiting, Coyote stood and stretched like a cat.
The winds have come.
During the long wait, some Reds had driven from Mariotas to aid in the rescue, and Coyote had worked out a plan of attack with them based on information Spencer had sent out. They were going to split up and come on the town from several angles. Michelle and Maya were to drive one car onto the cracked terrain of the outer bank, where they could hide at the foot of a small mesa within sight of the outer bank tents. One of these tents contained a medical clinic where Sax was being taken some of the time, a fairly low-security place according to Spencer, at least compared to the holding compound on the inner bank where Sax was being kept between sessions in the clinic. His schedule was staggered, and Spencer couldn't be sure which location he would be in at any given time. So when the wind hit, Michelle and Maya were going to enter the outer bank tent and meet Spencer, who would be there ready to guide them to the clinic. The bigger car with Coyote, Kasei, Nergal, and Art Randolph was going to converge with some of the Reds from Mariotis on the inner bank. Other Red cars would be doing their best to make the raid look like a full-scale attack from all directions, particularly the east.
We will make the rescue, Coyote said, frowning at his screens. The wind will make the attack.
So the next morning, Maya and Michelle sat in their car waiting for the winds to arrive. They had a view down the slope of the outer bank to the big Lemniscate Ridge. Through the day, they could see into the green bubble worlds under the tents on the outer bank and the ridge, little terrariums overlooking the red sandy sweep of the valley, connected by clear transit tubes and one or two arching bridge tubes. It looked like burrows some 40 years before. Patches of a city growing to fill a big desert arroyo. Michelle and Maya slept, ate, sat, watched. Maya paced the car. She had been getting more nervous every day, and now she padded about like a caged tigress that has smelled the blood of a meal. Static electricity jumped off her fingertips as she caressed Michelle's neck, making her touch painful. It was impossible to calm her down. Michelle stood behind her when she sat in the pilot's chair, massaging her neck and shoulders as she had his, but it was like trying to knead blocks of wood, and he could feel his arms getting tense from the contact. Their talk was disconnected and desultory, wandering in random jumps of free association. In the afternoon, they found themselves talking for an hour about the days in Underhill, about Sax and Hiroko, and even Frank and John. "Do you remember when one of the vaulted chambers collapsed?"
"No,"
she said irritably. "I don't. Do you remember the time Ann and Sax had that big argument about the terraforming?"
"No," Michelle said with a sigh. "I can't say I do."
They could go back and forth like that for a long time, until it seemed they had lived in completely different Underhills. When they both remembered an event, it was cause for cheer. All the First Hundred's memories were growing spotty, Michelle had noticed, and it seemed to him that most of them recalled their childhoods on Earth better than they did their first years on Mars. Oh, they remembered their own biggest events and the general shape of the story, but the little incidents that somehow stuck in mind were different for everyone. Memory retention and recollection were getting to be big clinical and theoretical problems in psychology, exacerbated by the unprecedented longevities now being achieved. Michelle had read some of the literature on it from time to time, and though he had long ago given up the clinical practice of therapy, he still asked questions of his old comrades in a kind of informal experiment, as he did now with Maya. "Do you remember this? Do you remember that?" "No, no, no." "What do you remember?" "The way Nadia bossed us around," Maya said, which made him smile. "The way the bamboo floors felt underfoot. And do you remember the time she screamed at the alchemists?"
"Why, no," he said.
On and on it went, until it seemed that the private underhills they inhabited were separate universes, Riemannian spaces that intersected each other only at the plane at infinity, each of them meanwhile wandering in the long reach of his or her own idiocosmos.
"I hardly remember any of it," Maya said at last, darkly. "I can still barely stand to think of John, and Frank, too. I try not to. And then something will trigger something and I'll be lost to everything else while I remember it. Those kinds of memories are as intense as if what you remember only happened an hour before, or as if it were happening again." She shuddered under his hands. "I hate them. Do you know what I mean?"
"Of course. Mémoire involontaire. But I remember also that the very same thing happened to me when we were living in Underhill, so it isn't just getting old."
"No, it's life. What we can't forget. Still, I can hardly look at Kasei."
"I know. Those children are strange. Hiroko is strange."
"She is. But were you happy then, after you left with her?"
"Yes." Michelle thought back on it, working hard to recall. Recollection was certainly the weak link in the chain. "I was, certainly. It was a matter of admitting things I had tried to suppress in Underhill. That we are animals. That we are sexual creatures." He kneaded her shoulders harder than ever, and she rolled them under his hands.
"I didn't need reminding of that," she said with a short laugh. "And did Hiroko give that back to you?"
"Yes, but not just Hiroko. Evgenia, Raya, all of them, really. Not directly, you know, well, sometimes directly, but just in admitting that we had bodies, that we were bodies, working together, seeing and touching each other. I needed that. I was really having trouble. And they managed to connect it to Mars as well. You never seemed to have trouble with that part either, but I did, I really did. I was sick. Hiroko saved me. For her, it was a sensuous matter to make our home and food out of Mars. a kind of making love to it, or impregnating it, or midwifing it. In any case, a sensuous act. It was this that saved me. This and their bodies, Hiroko's and Evgenia's and Raya's. She looked over her shoulder at him with a wicked grin, and he laughed. That you remember well enough, I bet. Well enough. It was midday, but to the south, up the long throat of Ekkis Chasma, the sky was darkening. Maybe the wind is coming at last, Michelle said. Clouds topped the great escarpment, a tall mass of highly turbulent cumulonimbus clouds, their black bottoms flickering with lightning, striking the top of the cliff. The air in the chasm was hazy, and the tents of Cassay Vallis were defined sharply under this haze, little blisters of clear air standing over the buildings and curiously still trees, like glass paperweights dropped on the windy desert. It was only just past noon. They would have to wait until dark, even if the winds did come. Maya stood and paced again, radiating energy, muttering to herself in Russian, ducking down to take looks out of their low windows. Gusts were picking up and striking the car, whistling and keening over the broken rock at the foot of the little mesa behind them. Maya's impatience made Michelle nervous. It really was like being trapped with a wild beast. He slumped down in one of the driver's seats, looking up at the clouds rolling off the escarpment. Martian gravity allowed thunderheads to tower tremendous heights into the sky, and these immense white anvil-topped masses, along with the stupendous cliff face under them, made the world seem surrealistically big. They were ants in such a landscape. They were the little red people themselves. Certainly they would make the rescue attempt that night. They had had to wait too long as it was. On one of her restless turns, Maya stopped behind him again and took the muscles between his shoulders and neck and squeezed them. The squeezes sent great shocks of sensation down his back and flanks, and then along the insides of his thighs. He flexed in her clutches and turned in the rotating seat so that he could put his arms around her waist and his ear against her sternum. She continued to work his shoulders, and he felt his pulse pumping in him and his breath grow short. She leaned over and kissed the top of his head. They worked their way against each other until they were tightly wrapped together, Maya kneading his shoulders all the while. For a long time, they stayed like that. Then they moved back into the living compartment of the car and made love. Tight with apprehension as they both were, they fell into it with intensity. No doubt the talk of Underhill had started this. Michelle recalled vividly his illicit lusts for Maya in those years, and buried his face in her silvery hair, and tried his best to merge with her, to climb right into her. Such a big feline animal she was, pushing back in an equally wild attempt to take him in, which effort carried him completely away. It was good to be by themselves, to be free to disappear into surprised ravishment, nothing but a series of moans and yelps and electric rushes of sensation. Afterward, he lay on her, still inside her, and she held his face and stared at him. "In Underhill, I loved you," he said. "In Underhill," she said slowly, "I loved you, too. Truly. I never did anything about it because I would have felt foolish, what with John and Frank. But I loved you. That was why I was so angry at you when you left. You were my only friend. You were the only one I could talk with honestly. You were the only one who really listened to me." Michelle shook his head, remembering. "I didn't do a very good job of that." "Maybe not. But you cared about me, didn't you? It wasn't just your job." "Oh, no, I loved you, yes. It is never just a job with you, Maya. Not for anyone or anything." "Flatterer," she said, pushing him. "You always did that. You tried to put the best interpretation on all the horrible things I did." She laughed shortly. "Yes, but they weren't so horrible." "They were," she pursed her mouth. "But then you disappeared. She slapped his face lightly.
You left me.
I left, anyway. I had to. Her mouth tightened unhappily, and she looked past him into the deep chasm of all their years, sliding back down the sine curve of her moods into something darker and deeper. Michelle watched it happen with a sweet resignation. He had been happy for a very long time, and just in that expression on her face, he could see that he would, if he stayed with this, be trading his happiness, at least that particular happiness, for her. His optimism by policy was going to become more of an effort, and he would now have another antinomy to reconcile in his life, as centrifugal as Provence and Mars, which was simply Maya and Maya. They lay side by side, each in his or her own thoughts, looking outside and feeling the rover bounce on its shock absorbers. The wind was still rising, the dust now pouring down Ekkis Chasma and then Cassay Vallis in a ghostly mimicry of the great outflow that had first carved the channel. Michelle pushed up to check the screens. Up to 200 kilometers per hour. Maya grunted. Winds had been far faster in the old days, but with the atmosphere so much thicker, these slower speeds were deceptive. Present-day gales were much more forceful than the old, insubstantial screamers. Clearly, they would go in tonight. It was only a matter of getting Coyote's bursted signal. So they lay back down together and waited, tense and relaxed at the same time, giving each other thorough massages to pass the time and relieve the tension, Michelle marveling throughout at the cat-like grace of Maya's long, muscular body, ancient by the dates, but in most respects the same as ever, as beautiful as ever. Then finally sunset stained the hazy air and the monumental clouds to the east, clouds which now covered the cliff face. They got up and sponged down and ate a meal and dressed and sat in the driver's seats, getting nervous again as the quartz sun disappeared and the stormy twilight fell away.
This ends side two of cassette 8 of Green Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 9.